Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Morelia Python Radio. Tonight we have more Bolens talk with Ari Flagel. He's coming on to give us some really good Bolens info. I recently picked up his book. I can't recommend it enough. If you can get your hands on a copy of it, definitely pick it up. And it's really a good read. I was just saying before the show, talking to the guys, and I'm definitely going to have to read it again because there's so much information in there that you can't digest it in one sitting. So, and he's working on a second book, so we're going to hit on that as well. But without further ado, I welcome my co-host, Owen, to the show.
Well, you were on such a roll. I didn't really want to stop you. It sounded so good. And I'm like, go. Maybe I wanted to speak at all.
Yeah.
So it was... I was going to ask you, is it more or less information than the complete carpet python?
It's different.
Different?
Yeah, it's different. It's definitely different. I like I said before, I said a couple shows back, I think one of the coolest things that I saw in the book is, you know, of course, I don't know, maybe I'm going to show how stupid I am or whatever.
Right.
When I opened up the book, I got in the mail, the first thing I did is I looked through and I flipped through and looking at the pictures. You know, so I'm like, oh yeah, okay, cool, you know, and I'm flipping through, and then I get to the genus Morelia, and I was like, oh wow, and it has a detailed pictures of adults and then juvenile specimens, the whole genus. So of course, you know, for me being a Morelia nut and having to have the whole set.
You just wrote down the list of things. It's like, got that one's on my list. That one, oh crap, I missed that one. Write down. Yeah.
Well, it's cool just to know, like, you know, this is where I would like my collection to be.
That's what it'll look like.
One day. You know.
Do you have pictures of them now, like, in empty cages in your room? So, like, you know, be like, you know, that's my imbricata over there.
One day
cage.
You will occupy this cage, yeah. And there's some cool shots of Owen Pelly in there. So, you know, I really enjoyed that.
Oh,
so,
yeah. Well, I love it now because of what we are. Every single picture of Owen Pelly Pythons that ends up on Facebook has you tagged in it.
I know.
Like, Eric, that's Owen Pelly. It's like, yep, there it is. So,
yeah.
Apparently, you have a cult following with the Owen Pelly now.
It's going to be very disappointing if I don't get, you know, the first ones available in the States.
Just like how I may lose my brain if I don't get Rough Scales in the next year or two.
Yeah. Your story. Well, they're in there too. Yeah, a couple pictures of those, you know. But yeah, definitely a cool book. But you know, we'll have him on in a second. What's new with you?
Oh, over here is just craziness. I mean, babies are eating second sheds on the Carmel Tigers. No, I don't have pictures before you even ask. Doing some other stuff. We just acquired ourselves another big female black phase wet lip. So it's like, oh my God, we actually found one. And she's a bitch. I mean, she's a monster. I mean, my other female is very chill. You can go in the cage, you pull her out, you hold her, you walk around, whatever. It's like, I'm like, and that was the basis of all my wet lip stuff. Is I'm like, okay, these guys are getting a bad rap. No, they're not. I mean, this female, oh, Jesus. And, you know, it's very good practice for me because I did just get the Barnex. So now I'm like, all right, this is what it feels like to have an 8-foot python mad as hell at you. So
yeah,
I can't imagine a 14-footer. So
it's like a heat-seeking missile, pretty much. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, and they do the Barnex thing, because apparently I'm told the Barnex, when they jump out of the cage and land on the floor, they will stand up so that, you know, they can get a better view of killing you. She stands right up, and I'm just like, my God. And I keep looking at my Barnex. And my Barnex are beautiful little babies. And I keep looking at them and go, God damn it. You guys are going to get huge.
Now,
terrible.
I got a question for you. You got your Barnex from David, right? Okay. Are yours, do you notice a difference in there? Is one more aggressive than the other? Are they both pretty placid, or what's?
Boy is very chill. The girl mm-hmm. has her moments.
Okay.
They're both pretty tame by the world of scrub. I mean, I only have the working with my Malukans, and with my Malukans, my older ones were always jerks, which I assume just because they're older, where my younger ones that, you know, we got when they were ugly little hatchlings were very calm, very chilled. I actually have one of my younger ones is down here at site A, and he's very chilled out and very cool. But my patternless adult female will try to, you know, eat your face and be successful if you're within range. But so I'm noticing that the Barnex, they're pretty chill. I was handling both of them a lot. They are being handled a lot because we want to keep them somewhat tameable. I have noticed the girl is a little bit more flighty, and she seems to be thinking a lot more. Like, everything is kind of calculated, and especially with her movements. She always wants to be in one place, and then she kind of just erupts, and now she's on the ground going that way. It's like, oh, crap, we should get that. So
yeah, the pair I have, the male is definitely very, very laid back, very chill. But David had worked with that one for
mm-hmm.
a year before I picked it up. Now the female, she was she's a year later than the male.
Okay.
And that's the one that I'm responsible for.
Is there a noticeable difference?
Well, yeah. I mean, she was very, very aggressive. You know, David gave me some tips with, you know, I remember him telling me when I first picked them up to, he said, you know, make sure that you get them. I hate using the word tame because it's not tame, but, you know, handleable at a young age, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, but she's definitely chilled out.
Good.
Which is good. But I definitely never trust them 100%.
Hell no.
But yeah.
I wonder if yours and mine are from, I don't know, if they're siblings or, like, you know, siblings from different years or something like that.
I think my female might be sibling to yours.
Okay.
Not 100%, but the male actually was produced by Dave Prada. It was something that, I wanted an unrelated pair. And he had picked up I guess he had a group of them that he must have picked up from Dave Prada. And
Prada got rid of his, so yeah, I guess he was unloading everything or something like that.
Right. So
yeah.
I was telling you before the show, I did some trade stuff.
Yeah, I saw a zebra jag that I remember seeing coming out of an egg pop up, and it wasn't under your name. I'm like, oh goodness. How'd you escape, little bugger?
Yeah.
So.
Matt Lacoste. I met him up at the White Plains area, and I was telling you what a fun trip that was.
And you know what? Think about it this way. It's fun and it's hateful for us, and we don't vend it.
And we drive from Pennsylvania to New York.
Yeah.
Jason Balin drives from Maryland and has to get up there and stand at a table and do all the vending stuff. Howard is telling me that, like, sometimes he doesn't leave because, like, Howard says he's now getting a hotel room up there every time there's a White Light plane show. But he was telling me he's got to leave by, like, 2 a.m. his place to get to Jason's place to leave by, like, you know, 4-ish to get the White planes in time.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's dedication right there.
That's insanity, but yeah, all right. So, but then he's like, or I can get the hotel room and, like, drive 20 minutes down the road in the morning at, like, 8:30. I'm like, God damn, get the hotel room. So.
Yeah. I think we were both one of the things I acquired in the trade was a pair of the PC line M-Pen IJs. And when I tell
those
you
letters
that,
mean wonderful things to us. Other people get confused, but
yeah. Well, I guess I should maybe elaborate on some more.
Probably
listeners. PC stands for the line of Irian Jayas. That our poster child was I think Yasser. They came from Yasser, and they're almost hypo-ish. They're definitely very, very cool IJs, and of course, M-Pen is Michael Pinnell's line
of
IJs, which is very cool. I was talking to Luke the other day, Luke Snell, and I was talking to him. Then I think I have converted to the dark side.
No.
Wait a minute, you have multiple. You can't convert to any side. You're you. I mean, there's no side. If there's a middle line, you walk it complete for all morphs, colors, breeds.
True story. But I guess hatching out the IJs this season, and actually they're really starting to color up and really show, like, I guess the potential. And they're really looking good.
Darksiders are just trying to claim you as theirs. That's why they're saying that you're a Darksider, you know.
Yeah.
All right. It's okay.
But, you know, I have to show you these IJs in person because, you know, I've seen the pictures of them online. And, you know, as me and Matt were talking or whatever, and I had expressed interest in that clutch way back in 2000 and the beginning of 2000. Of the beginning of 2012 season, which was actually 2011.
Yeah.
And,
you do play a long game when you want carpet pythons.
Yeah. And I saw the pairing and I was interested in it and I talked to him. But apparently he had bought the whole clutch because he did some kind of loan or something with Shad Quill and he had bought the whole clutch back from Shad, so I'm trying to contact Shad to see, you know, what we can work out. And he said, I sold the whole clutch. I'm like, damn it. You know, then I saw it popped up from Matt. And, you know, basically he said that he wasn't letting anything go from the clutch. And then, you know, we were talking back and forth and some of the different things that he wanted to get into. And I said, maybe we can work something out. And, you know, we did. But they're definitely – very, very cool. It's really, really cool. So,
see, and this may be the thing that you may have to save me from because I'm getting more and more jungles, and I'm liking the contrast between the black and the yellow.
Right.
So, if this radio show goes where you go light side, if you go dark side and I go light side, I don't know what to think.
we're like yin and yang. You know what I mean? So,
it's just never gonna work.
Oh yeah. I wanted to, before we get into it with Bolin's talk, I wanted to just say this Saturday is going to be Hamburg.
Yes.
I'm not sitting there, but I'll be heading up there. I know Howard Redding from Redding Reptile Breeders is going to be there. So
right.
Jason Balin from East Coast Serpent.
Mo will be there, right?
I believe so. Not 100%, but I'm pretty sure she'll be there. So Mo from Mojo Reptiles. So looking forward to seeing them. So if you're going to be out and about, I guess I'll wear my Carpet Fest T-shirt, and I'll probably be the only one with one of them on. So if you see Carpet Fest T-shirt, come
throw
up.
Throw something
and,
at it. Yeah.
yeah, exactly. So.
You should carry around a Rogue Reptiles T-shirt so I can just be there in spirit. So, fortunately, I have one of those things called a job, and
well,
they like me working.
Yeah, usually it's me that can't get off work, so.
Exactly, what the hell?
Yeah.
I can't ever be in one place at the same time.
yeah, that's pretty much all that's going on, so.
Cool.
I guess without further ado, we'll get this show
bowling
going.
Python. Do you have your pen ready so you can start making notes of what you want for your bowlings?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Hey, Ari, welcome back to the show. Glad to have you back. How you doing?
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me. It's going to be a good show tonight. I had a blast last time. I'm really glad you invited me to come back out.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, of course. We can't get all the info in one fell swoop. So
I don't know if I'll be able to give it to you all this one either. So.
Good. We'll have a third one.
I'll try.
See, we always look for more shows.
There you go. That works.
We hit on kind of the surface the last show, and we got into some of the the basic topics, if you will, of bowlings, pythons, and I was wanted to go maybe a little more in depth and talk about some different things. But I guess first of all, what's going on with you? How's things in the in your bowlings python world?
Everything seems to be good. I'm working with a couple little guys that I just recently brought in, so that's always fun. And then the adults that I'm maintaining at the zoo, as well as the animals in my private collection, all seem to be doing good. We're moving really strong with this UV project that I talked a little bit about last time. So it's going really well, and we're starting to see a lot of really cool similarities that we're getting now, which is really exciting. So. Everything seems to be going good, it's a good day with bowlings, so.
Cool. So I guess before we get into it, I wanted you, I was reading the book, and like I said at the beginning of the show, some of the things that I found interesting about it was one of them being the climate of New Guinea that you hit on in the book, and I wanted you to talk a little bit maybe about what your experiences are and give us like an idea of what it's actually like over there in New
Guinea. Sure, no problem. First off, thank you for the really kind words to begin with. It was I'm really glad that you enjoyed the book. It was a labor of love for sure. One of the most painful things I've ever had to do in my life, but I'm glad it came out the way it did, and I felt like it was time for something like that to be out and all the people that helped out, which was great. But the climate over there is just it's bizarre. It's a different world. I think I talked a little bit about it last time, but it's just really very strange. You would consider rainy season, dry season, but it relatively rains all year round. Maybe a little bit heavier this time, a little drier this time, but it's pretty consistent throughout the year. There's a little bit of subtleties every once in a while, but it's very odd, especially to find an animal of that size up at that elevation, being able to maintain itself. It's just extremely specialized for being able to inhabit this area, and they have got it down to a T. We're having difficulties as it is trying to do reproduction in captivity, and within the last several years, I feel pretty comfortable that we've been able to achieve a successful way for maintaining them just healthy enough as it is. But the environment is just it's so dense. It's sopping wet at times, and then it's bone dry at times. It's in, cloud cover comes by in a couple hours, and the temperature drops, and then you've got this blistering UV, and it's just, it's like a Jurassic Park. That's probably the best way I describe it when people ask me. It's, cannibals. I mean, they don't really do it anymore, but, it's still cool to say cannibals, It's just a place that it's an incredible mystical place. I mean, it sounds kind of cheeseball, but that's probably the best way to describe it. It really sticks out when you go to experience it. And I've been there twice now. I'm going to be returning in October again, and it's just quite a unbelievable experience when you're there.
Now, would you say that the bolins are, like, hardier than some other species when it comes to their natural climate? I mean, you just described all this crazy, crazy weather that I'm pretty sure almost any other species of snake out there would just get up respiratory and die. I mean,
well, you know, yeah, that's, I mean, exactly. I mean, temperature is, you know, a consistent temperature for these guys. I mean, they don't, you would, when you experience, I'm trying to think how I'd say it. I mean, constant temperatures in captivity, the way I'm maintaining my animals is, you know, my days are, you know, in the mid to upper 70s, and then, you know, you've got your isolated basking areas.
Right.
And, you know, the temperatures drop routinely, you know, into the 60s and lower, and, you know, in certain times of the year, they're down into the, you know, upper 40s for certain periods of time. But, I mean, when you're out there, you're, you know, experiencing a temperature that's also being, you're also being exposed to this ultraviolet exposure, which makes you feel like you're in an oven. So it's a very, different feel. You know, 78 degrees is great when you're walking around in a jungle because, you know, you got that humidity and yada, yada. But then you're being exposed with these little patches of light that break through, as well as up on the top of these areas, and it just cooks you. So, I mean, I was talking to a friend of mine, and he said, you know, they're a python. They should breed like a python. You know, but why aren't they? You know, it's like, but
What's wrong with them?
Yeah, exactly. What's wrong? They, you know, they're a python. Why can't they breed like a python? But they're just being exposed, and they're so, you know, in tune with what's going on there that it's incredible. I mean, we're getting very close, and with finding these little different subtle cues and observations that we're making to, in all honesty, make it say, okay, well, you know, they're found over here. Why can't we keep them like this? So I think a lot of it plays with the elevation, too, because it's just so high up, as well as some of this kind of climate that's that they're being exposed to daily.
Cool. Now, another thing that I was reading in the book was about the fact of their facial bands, and that they may assist in releasing excess heat. Is that?
Yeah, that's that was kind of. I remember coming across an old paper that was, I think it was the 1952 paper, L.B. Brongersma, and I think it was through that whole group, and they were talking about noticing little subtleties with the specimens that they collected originally and how their facial bandings and their chin patterning looked different. And they were also kind of considering it as a, almost like a sexual dimorphism thing. But I mean, ultimately they were basing this off of two or three animals. So it wasn't really, you're not really able to say that. I think it was just individual animal markings itself. But there's never really been any, you know, hard evidence to suggest that, yes, this is why it is. But, I mean, one could speculate that, you know, obviously they're colored the way they are to help absorb heat extremely quick because of these cold areas that they're being exposed to that they inhabit, and potentially having these lighter areas to help kind of, you know, regulate heat or deter heat from absorbing at this certain area, or, you know, vice versa. So it's, you know, it's kind of just purely speculation, but I thought it was definitely interesting to note that, you know, it could be a possibility. But once again, it's something that, you know, needs to be looked at more as well.
Sure. Now, can you, what's the thinking behind why some are yellow bands and some are white? Is that different localities at play, or?
That's like, that brings up a real kind of debatable topic, and unfortunately there's not a lot of data to support it. There's been animals that have been collected during the mid and late 70s that appearance-wise look different from what we see now. And the animals were collected on that eastern part of the island, more above Papua New Guinea, as opposed to Irianjaya, which is now referred to as West Papua, where all the animals we see nowadays are these leaner, you know, yellower banding and so on, as opposed to these larger animals that were being seen initially that had this kind of a pale, yellowish cream, almost white coloration. And, you know, a lot of people can dismiss it as, you know, okay, you know, being exposed to a certain environmental stimuli that maybe is, you know, this is a more natural thing that they should be exposed to, which would be causing them to display this color or something similar to that. But the real interesting fact about it is that a lot of the papers that were put out, even though there's hardly much literature put out before, describe these animals as white and black. As opposed to yellow and black, which we see now. So the divide pretty much seems to factor on the west part of the island and the east population. And there hasn't been it's very dangerous over in Papua New Guinea, so it's difficult to get over there, and especially to do anything with the reptiles because it's very, very regulated. It's just not a safe place to go to really do anything like that with any kind of a consistency, I think.
Right.
But it's not to really say that it is, you know, a locality thing or certain little populations have just developed this coloration because of some reason where it's, you know, lower elevation or a higher elevation or something like that. I remember I had spoken to Hank Malt when that Smuggled book came out, and because they mentioned the Bolans in it. And I tracked his phone number down, and it was a fantastic book. I really enjoyed it. I tracked him down and spoke to him on the phone. Very nice guy, very willing to share information. And he was telling me that, you know, the animals that they were illegally collecting during this time were these really heavy-bodied snakes that had virtually no patterning on their back, and they wore this pale yellow to cream banding on them. And they had a very large, more robust appearance to them. And he thought it was more because relating to the fact that the animals that they were finding were at a lower elevation than what we're typically seeing at the higher elevations in West Papua. And the animal abundance was larger where he was finding the animals. So these animals basically, in a nutshell, kind of adapted to be able to, you know, feed off of larger prey items, making them larger snakes. So this was just, you know, information, just an observation that he'd given me, not to say that this is what it is, but it was interesting that he also noted on them being a white and black snake versus a yellow and black. So I think ultimately to be able to determine if it is or not, you know, there needs to be a substantial amount of research conducted to be able to say that, you know, we find areas that, you know, have color variation and this could be why.
Right. Okay.
Now, is anything like the color variation in a diamond python? Because, like, from what I'm hearing with the way they have the lighter on the darker pattern and color, it almost reminds us when we talk to, like, diamond python breeders to say that the black with the yellow spots regulate heat, and there are white and yellow diamond pythons. So it's kind of like somewhere along the same lines with their pattern.
Yeah,
color.
You know, it certainly could be. The thing that really kind of makes me not dismiss the idea is the fact that you have all these reports from indigenous people there, and even back in the folklore relating to the animals, they describe the animals as a white and black snake, not as a yellow and black snake, which would suggest that these look differently for whatever reason, and majority of all those reports are coming from that eastern population versus the western population. So it's it could be absolutely nothing, but it could be something noteworthy to be able to look into later in the future as far as being able to try to do a survey where you're able to observe these animals and see if there is any kind of variation.
Okay. So are the two groups, are they separated by, I can't think of the mountain range right now. But...
Well, that whole spine of mountains that run through there, that Jayawijaya, and there's a couple other key mountains that the name just skips me right now for some reason, I can't believe. And the island itself is politically divided. So they're both inhabiting areas that are elevation-wise similar. But
okay.
To really say this is the only place you can find them, you can't really say that because the island is so unexplored. I'm sure there's thousands and thousands of little small micro pockets, you know, of sustained populations of these animals all over. I mean, they're certainly not, in my opinion, at risk of being, you know, wiped out on New Guinea because they're reproducing them, and we see babies come through every year multiple times, and, you know, there's animals that are out there. So it's just so difficult to be able to really access some of these areas. It's hard to really survey in my opinion, them well without spending a critical amount of time out there.
Right.
Have they done anything with testing these different pockets of bolins to see if there's potentially, like, different subspecies or anything like that? Because
There was a paper that was done, I think it was a year or two ago, and they collected, I can't remember the exact amount. It was a decent amount of animals. They collected DNA samples from these animals as well as captive animals, and they compared those animals to see if there was any kind of genetic difference. And there wasn't anything, from what I can remember from the paper, that would suggest a subspecies. But, I mean, it's still open, you know, in my opinion. I mean, the exciting thing about Bolan's pythons is we don't really know that much about them in the first place. So we're learning more and more about them, which gives us more possibility for new discoveries with the species as far as, okay, maybe we were looking in this region, but now we look up higher or further west or further east, and we'll find something that potentially could be a little different or a little divergent from everything else.
Right.
Cool.
Okay.
One of the another thing that I found interesting in the book was the whole thing with Bolans with the nest sites, and that they only take up, you know, they basically stay in their territory, and you equated it to about the size of a football field.
Yeah, I mean that's a relatively kind of a rough estimate. But from the information that we were able to gather, as well as observations from people there and people that have been there before, they were noticing certain amounts of animals that were inhabiting certain areas and typically like residing in these areas. The areas that you'd find them were heavily covered with scat and urate, as well as leftover sheds that were draped over, you know, rocks and branching and substrate and whatnot, where the animals were residing. And it'd be kind of interesting to kind of suggest that, you know, maybe these are serving as a biological marker for other animals, saying, hey, this is my territory, or, hey, this is an area where there's animals at for, you know, breeding or whatnot. We don't really know. But, it was interesting to note that, as opposed to, you know, something else that, you know, has a tendency to be more of a cruising snake as opposed to residing in one single area for a certain amount of time and kind of staying there for your reproduction or just life.
Okay. So these nest sites that they set up, this isn't something that they build. It's basically something that is like already kind of there and they just...
Yeah, a lot of it was, you see these ground mammals like large rodent species or some of these ground-dwelling birds, you know, they'd kind of rustle down into these limestone areas as well as just enough caverns in the limestone for the snakes to just basically reside down in and take over and just say, I'm going to stay here. This has everything that I need as far as temperature and humidity, you know, I can live in this for as long as I want. And they're basically taking over these spots and they just kind of feed themselves around in there and it kind of forms into a nest that they utilize.
Okay. And how does that differ from like the female's nest for her eggs?
I have not found a female on eggs yet. I'm hoping to on my next trip. That would be fantastic. But from the reports that I've gotten, it was interesting. My last trip when I was out there, I really focused heavily with the indigenous people that are collecting these animals and see them. And I wanted to kind of get as much information from them as far as what they were observing as I could and kind of relate it to what we had already. And a lot of the information I was getting, you know, obviously you have perception variation between us and them because, you know, they're paying attention to things differently than we would, where we'd be looking for these little fine little details. They would kind of miss, you know, look over that and look for something else. But one of the hunters told me that there was a place that he goes to every year and he collects babies to supply for suppliers. And he would see numerous shells from prior hatchings in these nest areas that the females were utilizing. Whether it was just a coincidence that it was a perfect place for the female to set up her shop and brood her eggs or whatnot, or if they were actually returning to that spot, nobody really knows. But it was interesting just to hear him say that, yeah, I found a old eggs that were, you know, old hatched eggs in the same nest that the female was in on new eggs. And there was even another snake in there with her, you know, and stuff like that. So it was kind of cool just to hear that and kind of relate it a little bit. It's difficult, like I said, to be able to really hold that as a definitive piece of you know, scientific data, but it's definitely worthwhile to note. And I recorded it and spoke with him a little bit longer too, so it was pretty interesting.
Are there any of the snakes that potentially could return to nest sites, or is this like the first time we've heard of any kind of behavior with that? With, because I've never heard of, you know, carpet pythons or anything like that going back to where they were hatched.
Yeah, I don't know. And I mean, and certainly I don't know if, I mean, I wouldn't suggest that this particular species would utilize that behavior, but it was interesting to note that the animal was seen in an area with old eggs, which would say, hey, this is an old nest. You know, whether or not that was her nest that she lived in, and you know, that was from the prior year, who knows? But you know, I'm not aware of any other species that do that, but I could definitely be wrong. But it's just something else to kind of like throw another wrench in it, you know, and say, it could have just been, you know, like absolutely had nothing to do with what was going on, or it could have a little bit of shred of
or it could be immensely important.
Exactly, yeah. But, or it could be absolutely garbage, so nobody knows.
But that's what makes it so much fun.
Yeah, that's what makes it so much fun. I really enjoy hearing the stories from the people there, because, I mean, they see the animals a lot. And a lot of it is just difficult. You've got to take in with a grain of salt, too, with what they're saying. Like I had heard some stories they were telling me about how I was talking to one of the locals and had my my good friend Tom Mendelson, who travels with me there, and he was asking him a question, and I just threw it out there. I'm like, you ever seen one that's white? And he said, yes. He goes, I saw a white one, and I saw it in, you know, 1994. And I'm just like, oh, okay, you know, and describe. And it was kind of like we were kind of looking at each other like, okay, yeah, maybe, whatever, you know. It's like, okay,
yeah.
I'm like, surely if we were just, if something like that was, you know, surfaced, I'm sure, you know, a collector out there or a supplier would have had that thing up for sale in 2 seconds, and you know, somebody would have photographed it. But it was just fun just kind of listening to the story about it. So and I've got some stuff like that in the new book I'm working on. So,
oh, cool.
Like you constantly get reports of bolens that are like, you know, bigger than three guys laying next to each other, something like that.
Yeah, the 50-foot bolens python.
Yeah,
you know,
my God.
The missionary's airplane as he was flying
my
over.
My father did.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, imagine this is a lot of the stories you're going to get.
A lot of that stuff, like the most of the stories that we would get would be, you know, how many animals like a clutch size, or how many animals they would find a year that they would collect. And then every once in a while you'd get something odd, like when I asked about that that odd animal, and they said, yeah. And I was like, oh, okay, you know, was that just because I suggested it, or was it, you know, that, you know, they'd actually seen something or what? But, you know, never anything gigantic. It was maybe sometimes like the bands would be, you know, more predominant, and they'd, you know, kind of candy cane, or there'd be no banding or something like that. So, you know, everybody has their own kind of interpretation of how to perceive it. But it was, needless to say, it was a lot of fun listening to the stories. I must have spoken to probably about a dozen people that had collected them out there, and they were
awesome.
Kind of relaying a lot of it. And I filmed it too. So it was it was pretty interesting.
Oh,
it is cool.
It must be pretty cool. You know, here's a species of snake that we're like fascinated with, and you know, to them it's like what we consider like a rat snake or something.
Well, you know, the interesting thing you say about that is, you know, a lot of these people, they really revere these snakes. I mean, they're very aware of them. Unfortunately, the majority of the people that are aware of them is because of the monetary value that they know they can achieve with these animals.
Right.
And
right.
They're, you know, they're depending on these animals to basically live, because they will go out and collect animals and provide those to people that would purchase them. So that's the unfortunate side of it. And then you've got people that, you know, tribes that are there that hold these animals in their folklore, that respect the animals and have folklore specifically revolved around these snakes that it goes back further and further than just somebody saying, hey, I know I can get $20 if I bring him a snake or something like that. So it's interesting. I mean, the people out there are aware of it, and they know, you know, that people come to Wamena to look for Bolan's pythons because it's like, you know, the Mecca spot to go in and look. So, you know, that's a lot of the people that are there know, you know, when they see, you know, a white person come through there that they're looking for reptiles, unfortunately. So
now on the farms in Indonesia, do they take, I mean, when they're breeding them there, or is it just typical python husbandry breeding?
I can't really speak for the other farms because I've only dealt with, I have a very, very close friend of mine. His name is Danny Gudelin, and he has a farm that is in Jakarta, and he specializes in a lot of reptiles as well as a lot of indigenous exotic mammals that he breeds with the government there. And he's actually one of the few people that are permitted to breed some of these protected species there. So he's a person that I do a lot of my work with. He's a part of my team as well as Tom Mendelson. And his basic husbandry for the animals, when I was able to observe his enclosures as well as the animals he had, the thing that I noted with them was they're these very large, elaborately designed enclosures that provide multiple areas for the animals to go to take advantage of different kinds of temperature gradients, basically everything that you would want to do if you were going to be doing like a really naturalistic enclosure. Aside from the limited materials that they have available, like his enclosures were actually very impressive and his facility was incredible. And he had these very elaborate kind of rock wall constructed enclosures for these animals, and they were probably like, you know, good, you know, 10 to 12 feet high by 20 feet deep. I mean, they were decent sized
wow.
enclosures with they each had shift doors on it so he could shift animals back and forth, and they had pools of water in there. I mean, it was very, very done well. But I don't know how the other facilities do as far as if they're reproducing them or not, because I focus primarily with my friend, and I know Danny has produced twice where it was documented with the government there. It was in 2005 and then 2007. And everything would suggest, you know, a typical python reproduction with the animals when he did it as well. So it's kind of one of those things where I was really excited to talk to his caretaker that took care of the Bolans and really kind of pick his brain and say, what did you do? You know, what were you doing? And it was like, oh, I did this. I sprayed him over here. I sprayed him over there. And, you know, give him a chicken and give him a rat.
And that was it.
And she laid eggs underneath
more.
His. And she laid a clutch of eggs underneath his pot. You know, so it was like, it was you know, it was very difficult because like I said prior, the attention to detail on some things are lost just because of how we perceive things as opposed to somebody else does. So, but I mean, needless to say, they were. It was phenomenal facility, and the enclosures were just incredible. So I've actually sent him out a bunch of ultraviolet lighting to utilize on some of his indoor enclosures as well, because not only does he have outdoor enclosures, but he's also got indoor enclosures for them too. So we were kind of playing around with the UV stuff to see if they were displaying a lot of the behavior that I was seeing with the captive animals, and they were, basically. So. But I know there's a couple facilities that are out there that have them as well, but I don't know what their breeding regimen is or how they have their animals set up. I'm sure, you know, they're set up accordingly. I would imagine it would be a, kind of like a standard, like a holding facility or a place that you'd set something up, not as much long-term as his.
Right. Now, these are the pictures that are in the book, right?
Yeah, they're the pictures of the babies hatching and the adults that are on the branch breeding in the tree.
Yeah,
those are Danny's animals. I think I got quite a few pictures of his that are in there that he was so gracious enough to really just provide. Like he really gave me some fantastic stuff. And some of the photos didn't make it in there as well. But the next one got some cool stuff. So
nice.
Oh, cool. You wanna hit a little bit on that since you brought it up?
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. I don't wanna give too much out because I don't want to ruin it. I mean, we're still working on it. We've been working on it for about, almost 8 months now, putting together a manuscript and all that, and trying to get a little bit more data. And I really wanted to take it in a different direction as opposed to the prior book, where the first book really kind of opened up the doors on the species and the environment and, captive and this and that. And I really wanted to go more towards, on this new one about the people. I wanted it more of an anecdotal kind of manuscript where it talked about the people and how they reflect with the animals, as well as a lot of stories about individuals that have worked with them in the past. I've got just like an incredible group of people that's contributing. Richard Ross is going to be involved as well. Carl Switek. I've got a good friend of mine, Steve Hammack, that'll be contributing information. Mark O'Shea, and then my friend Tom Mendelson, who's my partner, and then my good friend Danny Gunalin also. So it's going to have a lot of really interesting pieces from different people, and it'll all flow really, really nice, as well as having the typical, what we found to really work well with them in captivity up to this point, as well as a lot of diagrams for enclosures, new kind of temperature stuff, some new theories on, reproduction, and a lot more wild aspect of the species too. And I think I'm also going to have the UV project in there as well too. And
excellent.
Yeah, I almost forgot we have some really great footage that we got on the last trip about a lot of the interviews with the people and then just the environment itself. So we're going to be possibly including a DVD in it as well. Photos or actually a video from Danny of his clutch of Bolins. He hatched hatched a full clutch of eggs, and I've got like a 20-minute video of the entire clutch hatching, and it's just drooling good. So
nice.
It'll be interesting. I guess I'm wanting to put that in there as well, just to kind of change it up a little bit, as well as, like I said, provide the basic things that you would expect to find in the book, but really focus with the people and all these other people, like some of these really old herpers that have, back in the 70s and 80s when these snakes first came in, their kind of stories and stuff like that. I think it'd be really neat.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of like the back history. I like
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah. Trying to do a little bit of back history with it, so as well as some new stuff.
There'll
be plenty of new stuff, so don't worry.
Okay, cool.
Excellent.
I guess, we're sort of jumping around topic to topic, which is fine. But
we're all over the place. Yeah, yeah. Hey, that's fine.
One of the things that I wanted to hit on with you is the whole quarantine thing. I don't think that people focus on it as much as they should. And it's not something I don't know, maybe I'm hanging around with Owen too much. I don't know. But I don't hear it talked about maybe as much as it should. So I wanted you maybe to give a breakdown of
I agree with you, Eric. I'm sorry, Owen.
Okay.
It's all right. I definitely think quarantine is an important thing, especially when you're dealing with something that has the rarity factor and the price tag. Not to say that, quarantining, every day thing is not a good thing to do, but when you've invested a lot of time and money into something, especially like this, I definitely think it's something that you should be considering. I like to do a quarantine where the animals are obviously separated from everything else for, I think they usually do like 30 days, 30, 60 days to see if anything is really going to kind of manifest in that time. I like to get multiple fecals from things as well and run those to check, and then just be able to look for any kind of behavioral quirks that are not of the norm and kind of address it like that. But I definitely think it's a good thing to maintain as well as to utilize. Unfortunately, it's difficult for some people just because of the space, being able to, you know, say you've got a big room of herps already and you've got like a bunch of other stuff coming in. It's like, where are you going to put it? So it's one of those things. It's kind of a catch 22 thing. So, but, I agree. And I like to utilize it with the animals that I have as well. Cause I wouldn't want to bring something else in and, you know, you've worked so hard with it and then all of a sudden something happens and, you know, then it takes everything down. So, I mean, things do happen even though, you know, everything seems okay, but I agree. I think it's a good idea. Definitely.
Yeah. I think, I guess why I bring it up is, especially with dealing with Morelia, you know, I mean, some of Morelia scrubs and Bolins and, you know, some of this stuff is not really captive bred, you know, and established in captivity. So you're bringing in sometimes wild caught or some, you know, sometimes.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And you know, it's a real big thing to consider, especially if you've got people that, you know, I'm aware of individuals that have, you know, quite a few specimens and, you know, these animals are long-term captives and then you bring something else in, you run the risk of, you know, just crashing everything down and it's not worth it. So, I definitely agree. I think it's a good practice to maintain. But, you know, it's not always, feasible, in certain situations, but, I definitely agree that it's something to consider and to take advantage towards.
Is there maybe any way that you can sort of, any tips that you could give, say, you know, like you said, if space is an issue or something like that, is there anything that you could do to sort of quarantine something,
you know,
while being
in
the same room? I mean, I know in a perfect
same
situation.
Room, I don't know if it necessarily works if it's in the same room because you're, you know, the animals are being exposed to each other, regardless if they're on the same rack or if they're on the same wall or if they're underneath the cage. I think the most accurate, you know, or rather the most correct way to do it is have the animals, you know, out of that vicinity where those other animals are until you're, you know, sure that these guys are good to go. And then you can introduce them into your collection because it's just not worth it. I mean, if you've got something that's just, you know, just waiting for it. And a lot of times, you know, like you said, with these wild caught animals, you know, everything will seem fine. And then you'll have, you know, a stressor that you're not aware of that'll trigger something. And then you've got a whole mess of problems going through and it's just a nightmare.
I'm curious to can you tell us what would be when you have, say you're starting with a baby Bolin's python, how do you know, like what cues would you get when you feel that animal is acclimated to captivity?
Well, you know, based on just the experience I have with working with the adults and the neonates and the juveniles, I mean, I would feel comfortable with an animal that's passing visually appropriate looking fecals, you know, no presence of intestinal parasites are there when you're, you know, doing routine fecals. The animal's appearance looks good. It's feeding, you know, routinely. It's either shedding for you like it should be or, you know, it's you know, doing what it needs to be doing that you would expect. And certainly no odd behavior as far as, you know, kind of IBD or what else? Some of the other neurological things that are always a possibility. You know, and I would just, you know, I mean, it would be like observing any other animal that you've just brought in. You know, it's just this one's going to be a little harder to replace, I guess.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
Sad to say, but, you know, and, you know, you want to make sure the animal's drinking and, you know, and just behaving, you know, appropriately. You know, a lot of times, like, my adults are on a total routine and as well as the ones at the zoo, you know, I can – you know, I can think right now it's, you know, it's almost 9 o'clock in Texas. My females are in their nest box right now. My male's probably sitting outside waiting to get ready to go in his nest box. You know, it's 11 o'clock in the morning or, you know, it's getting ready to be noon and snakes are coming out to start basking, you know, and that's, you know, the kind of the normal thing with the animals that I'm exposed to being around. And it takes a little time, you know, some of the little ones have their own kind of behavior. So as well as the adults. So, I wouldn't just conclude that the animal's sick or, you know, messed up because his behavior is a little different from everybody else. It just might take him a little time to get on the routine with everybody.
Yeah.
Okay. If that makes sense.
Yeah.
It does.
Absolutely.
Good.
Let's see. What else do I have? The yeah, it's funny you say that. With you know, last night I was in my snake room, and that was the first time that I ever saw my chondro on the floor, like on the ground.
Yeah,
I've never seen that before, and I was freaking out, you know. So, huh. And there's nothing
well, yeah,
wrong,
it's,
I don't
you know,
think, but it's
yeah, everybody's like, you know, and it's interesting you bring that point. Joshua Esther, who has been on your show as well, and I've spoken to before, who's a very nice guy. He utilizes NestBox all the time, if I'm not incorrect, with his chondros, and they utilize it all the time.
Yeah.
Which would be like, hey, why, you know, why are these snakes coming down off the perch, you know, going into these areas? I mean, this is just behavior that, you know, we might just not be aware of noticing. So just because, you know, they're doing that, it doesn't mean, you know, that snake's all jacked up or something's wrong. I mean, before, I remember, you know, when chondros were coming in, people were like, oh, my God, the snake's on the ground. Oh, God, it's getting ready to die. You know, it's but, you know, it's maybe just didn't like that perch, or maybe it was just too hot up at the top and wanted to cool off.
Yeah. So this year we have a couple of successes with, well, one success with Bolens and one possible
one
success.
Maybe. We're kind of waiting.
I wanted your thoughts on, you know, just
yeah, it's been pretty exciting. We had Mark had a clutch of eggs. I don't know exactly how many eggs, but he got eggs, which was very exciting. I know he's been working very hard on getting these animals to go, as well as the other Bolens guys. So I was very excited to see that happened. So I'm hoping that, you know, that brings us a little closer to, you know, what we might be considering for, you know, successful reproduction later down the road. You know, if we can, you know, if he can replicate this again or shed light on something that he observed that, you know, might be a significant factor for us to consider. The other one is a gentleman in California. And his scenario is very different, and it looks like it might pan out. I don't want to say too much about it because I haven't spoken to him and share what's going on, but it looks
sure.
like, you know, he potentially could have, you know, a gravid female laying eggs soon, which would be very exciting because not just two clutches of Bolens in a year, but the way that he's maintaining his animals are completely different from this other scenario, which would be something for us to consider as to saying, okay, let's look in this different direction now that this is going on. So they're both very interesting, and the gentleman in California, I'm very excited to see what pans out from that animal. I've kind of spoken to him several times, you know, every couple of weeks to check on seeing how his snake's doing. It's kind of funny that you brought him up, and he says, you know, it's, you know, if I were to say that, you know, if this was something else, I'd say it's gravid, you know. And he's like, I keep checking, and then I'm like, oh, it's gravid. Oh, I don't know. Oh, it's gravid. I don't know. So but
I
sent
right
me a couple pictures, and it's like it's impressive to see what's going on. I mean, there's certainly something happening, and I'm just very excited to see if it pans out for him because, like I said, it will be the kind of unconventional method of maintaining the species and might let us kind of get a glimpse into an area that we can consider that we're overlooking.
Okay. Huh. Oh, you give us a little teaser.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I would give you guys all of it in a second. I'd give
yeah,
a call. I'm sure
yeah.
you wouldn't mind, but I just want to be like, you know, okay, you know, I don't want to say it, but
yeah.
But it'd be really interesting to see. Like I said, if it happens, I really hope that it goes through because it'd be really exciting. So, and then I had a female this year that I thought was going to go for sure. She got huge follicles, but just. When did the typical Bolens absorb? So we'll try again next year and see what happens.
Now, what did you do different, or what did you do this season that maybe you're gonna try?
Oh, you want all the secrets now. I come on the radio
yes,
second times, and you want all my secrets. Well, what I did really was I really was just paying attention a little bit more to the animal's behavior. I'm really sticking with my guns on this UV stuff I'm doing because it's really kind of giving me a window into the behavior change from point A to point B. And I think a lot of it was just the timing of my introductions weren't timed just right when the peak of her reproductive time was ready. I was also doing a lot more with humidity and the moisture and the enclosures during that time, and that's pretty much it. As opposed to, you know, temperatures being dropped, I wasn't going super duper low. At this point, I don't really. My belief is I don't feel that they have to be exposed to these super duper low temperatures. But I could be wrong. It'll depend to see if, you know, we get some more successes that are exposed to that low. But I'm having, you know, heavy follicular developments when the animals are getting down to the upper 50s, you know, 58 and even to the low 60s too. So which would suggest, you know, everything is good, but I might need to just crank that male down a little bit lower just to get him going. So.
Okay.
Are you a little worried about the temperature drops that you might have to be putting in on these guys?
Yes and no. I mean, they're so specialized in what they are. And as long as, you know, like I said, I'm really paying attention to these behavior traits that they're doing. So I'm pretty confident I can recognize any kind of, you know, signs that it's like, okay, we're going too low, we're too hot, stuff like that. But, you know, I mean, like I said, there's still so much that we don't know about them. But at this point with the regimen that I'm doing, you know, knock on wood, I don't have any doubts in my mind as far as the temperature drops or how warm it gets in the daytime. Everything seems to be maintaining. I mean, there was a lot of it, too, I think, is consistency with a specific kind of recipe that you're going to be utilizing. And I was speaking to a friend of mine about this a couple weeks ago, and he was saying, you know, that maybe they just need to be exposed to this specific, you know, recipe or regiment for, you know, a number of years, and then you throw in that change of your temp drop or something, or, you know, spray them down at this time and that time, and then that causes it, as opposed to, you know, I got them this year, I'm going to get them all ready to go, they should be able to go next year. So maybe they're just a long, you know, they need that long exposure to really kind of get them settled in.
Interesting.
They're just nuts.
Yeah,
you have, but it's worth it. I mean, it's worth it. Yeah, if it was easy, you know, it's like. But that's one of the things that I, you know, just love about Boland's pythons. I mean, I'm so passionate about working with them because it's not just the fact that we, you know, nobody can get them to breed consistently. It's like we just don't know anything hardly about them to the point we're at now. I mean, they just remain such an enigmatic. Mystery that we still just don't understand with how many animals were capable of reproducing, and this one remains still a problematic issue that we cannot figure out with any consistency. So that's just the allure with it, as well as just how cool they look. I mean, it's just they're just awesome, and the environment that they're in is just incredible.
I have a hypothetical question for you. Just
sweet, go for it.
Just if you were to get a clutch of eggs, like say next season, would you sell any of the babies?
You know, I was often been asked that. You know, and you know, it's one of those things. To be honest with you, I can't lie. I probably would let a pair go.
Okay.
But the holdbacks, obviously. But I think one of the things that I would really like to do, and I've spoken to people about this, is kind of send off, you know, a couple pairs or lone animals to other individuals that have the animals or facilities that are working with them, and kind of try to replicate what I did that worked, if it did. I mean, I would to feel comfortable with it, I would have to do it multiple times to be able to say, okay, this really helped out, you know, as opposed to doing it once. Because with doing it once, it's just kind of like, okay, you know, maybe I really did it, or maybe I just lucked out. So,
right.
With the consistency factor, I definitely, I would feel very comfortable sending animals off to individuals to kind of build up some kind of a program, like a breeding program, to get a captive, like a real captive population established in captivity.
Right.
But yeah, I would definitely sell a pair. I'd have to, I got bills too. So, but
fair enough. I
so
just, you know, I think
down your door.
Yeah.
Put me on the list now.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if it would be one of those things with, you know, what we've seen with other python species, that once you get captive, born and bred babies, is it going to be much easier, do you think? Or
well,
are we going to have to keep
That's a great, you know, area to consider. You know, I would say yes and no, because you would think yes, and what we know from these younger animals that we're able to get in is they acclimate so much better than these wild-caught animals that we used to be able to get in. So I would like to say hypothetically, yes, they would, but it's a Bolan's python. So there still remains possibly a trigger that we're just overlooking or something that we're just not doing right. That, you know, I feel confident that we'll be able to figure out soon. You know, somebody will hopefully take note of it, and it'll be able to establish a population of them or allow it for us to be able to reproduce them in captivity with some consistency, which I hope is possible.
Has anybody tried to breed them at another time of year? Like, I know some they have?
I have.
Okay.
I don't know if...
We have you on the show.
Yeah, I know, right? typically, you know, the heavier, you know, breeding times in the wild, from what we get, is, you know, May, June, July, middle to end of August, and then, you know, you've got, you know, eggs and then hatching. But Bolan's pythons will breed anytime typically you put them together. The males just enjoy copulation, which, which is no problem. It's fine.
Yeah, fair enough.
It's like, you know, they seem to be, you know, breeding heavier in the drier season as opposed to the rainy season, which is kind of a little flip-flop. But I'm seeing, like, really heavy follicular development with just my study, you know, really, really heavy stuff March, April, you know, getting to that approach of those peak breeding times in the wild. But I've tried, you know, multiple times. I've tried, you know, November. I can get really good copulation in November, but I'm not getting, you know, follicular development from the behavior I'm seeing. So, you know, they will breed pretty much whenever you stick them together, but I've seen, you know, I haven't seen too much to really suggest that they'll, you know, that might be a factor yet, but I could be wrong. I mean, I know they're breeding twice a year because they're, you know, I think my notes were, they start their, the heavy follicular development I typically see the end of February to April. And then the breeding starts in the wild, and then they go through another follicle development stage, the end of November, beginning of December, which they start really developing then too. So, I mean, which would make sense because we see multiple clutches becoming available in the private sector, you know, coming through, you know, twice a year sometimes. So,
right.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I was going to say, I guess my thinking was if they're so close to the equator that maybe there's not a huge swing in seasons.
Yeah, I mean, the seasons are – it's like really – like when we were talking beginning, it's real odd.
It's just
like what was it?
Wet and dry, right?
Yeah, it's just pretty much wet and dry, but it's not like a consistent – like, you know, when you go to the Amazon, it's like, oh, it's rainy season. It just dumps, you know.
Right.
As opposed to dry season where it's just like bone dry. I mean, the rainy seasons are typically a little heavier rain. It's November through April. And then, you know, the dry seasons are like, I think May, October around there. It could be off a little bit, but I mean, it's, and also then you've got to consider elevation too. With playing it. And then, you know, they're typically inhabiting, you know, these ranges, 65 to 8,500 feet. And in that range, you've got bands of weather that's coming through, so you've got all this different climactic change. So it's just a nightmare. It's just a black and yellow or a black and white nightmare. That's what it is. So.
Wow. Now, are they the only python species at that elevation? You're not seeing chondros or carpets or anything up in that?
I have not seen any other snakes up there. Typically, what I've seen are I've found some small frogs. I have found some small skinks. I found a gonocephalus species when I was there last time. It was just too darn fast for me to grab to identify what it was. But I have heard there is an amethystine that's up there that goes up into that level.
Yeah,
but
that's
I have not.
The oskbills?
Yes, the oskbill.
Yeah.
that Orange Mountain one I've heard that can go up to that level, but I'm not very familiar with the species, so I don't know what their elevation max is. And I wouldn't be surprised if chondros would go up pretty high, but I don't know what their cutoff range would be.
Okay.
But I mean, they're certainly down in the, you know, in Wamena area. I mean, but I don't know if they're up that high up. I'm not a big chondro guy, so I don't know what their elevation limit would be really. But that amethystine I've heard is found in that same area.
Oh, okay. Yeah, they say, and it's weird that they're also difficult to breed in captivity as
well.
Yeah,
you know, I was listening to you guys talking about your scrubs and how you got them from David. And mm-hmm. I've spoken to David. He's a really nice guy. And we've kind of, you know, talked about the Bolin stuff and, you know, the difficulty with, you know, reproduction with the scrubs and trying to relate it with the Bolins too. So we've kind of bounced some ideas back and forth also. So, I mean, I'm always up for trying different ideas. I'm not set in stone with my regimen as far as what I'm doing. I try to keep it consistent, but if there's something different that somebody might suggest or somebody might note, I'll definitely give it a try and say, hey, this, you know, this works, as opposed to saying this is the only way you can do it, you know. So
right.
But,
yeah. Okay. Yeah, we've talked to I've talked to him in depth too about his he's pretty much one of the only guys I know. Well, there's a couple guys, but I guess the one that I talked to the most that has has had success with them, you know.
Yes, he's very, very knowledgeable with those
yeah.
snakes, and like I said, a very nice guy, very willing to share information, and just, you know, I think when I was with this female that I mentioned that I had that was just building these huge follicles, and I thought it was a good to go. You know, we were talking, and I think I called him every day for an update and saying, okay, this is what we're doing now. He's like, oh my God. He goes, you know, if this was anything else, I would say yes. He's like, but taking in what it is, I don't want to say anything. So it was kind of like we were bouncing ideas back and forth. So it was he's a really nice guy, very knowledgeable.
Awesome.
Sorry, my thing is messed up here.
Oh, great. Let me tangle the
selfies again. I'm good. Sorry.
Anyways.
I have to get a new headset because this thing just...
Okay.
I know we've talked about Bolins being at higher elevations.
Uh-huh.
Like, is there people in Denver that are having good jobs with these guys?
Well, you know, a lot of people are like, oh, you know, they're a high elevation snake. Let's bring them up in higher elevation and see what works.
Into the mountains. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Let's bring them to the mountains. Yes and no. I mean, I have not heard of any other reproductions except for these for Mark's just recently, and then another one. As far as keeping them alive, I don't really think it plays a huge factor, but I could be wrong. My friend Danny, that's in Indonesia, lives his facility and his farm is in Jakarta, which is in the middle of a city, and he's reproduced them twice. So it's I don't know what it is. I really don't have an answer. It's just something that we're not paying attention to, and I have a feeling that it's going to be something very simple. That we're just kind of overplaying them maybe because of what they are, which is not a thing that, you know, is a bad thing. But I think it could be something that's just very simple that we're just not taking in looking at it for what it is.
Right.
Right.
Hmm. I mean, they're a python, so theoretically they should breed like a python. But that's not the not the case right now because we would have Bolins everywhere, which would be way cool, but on the same side, you know, it's still really, they're so, you know, secretive of what they are. And, you know, just there's, when you see one, I, you know, people are like, always like, well, why do you like them so much? And I'm like, when you see one and you get to touch one, you know, then come and talk to me again. And then you'll understand why I like them so much. It's that awe that you get when you look at them. And then when you touch them, you're just like, oh my gosh, this is incredible.
Yeah, I know there's some species of, you know, I think your white lips were like that, Owen, when I saw them.
Oh,
at the
white
show.
Lips are awesome. I love white lips.
I love my white lips.
Yeah. Yeah, I heard.
You know, it's just something about, you know, seeing the animal in real life as opposed to seeing a picture of it that just, you know,
mm-hmm.
and imagine that the Bolins have that same iridescence and
Yeah, they, it's just,
sheen.
there's just some species that are just, I mean, all reptiles are incredible in my opinion. And just some of them just, you kind of go into these different levels and just some of them just branch out in these little groups where you look at it and you just kind of, your jaw drops. And it's just like, and Bolin's kind of, in my opinion, fall in that kind of class as far as just, they're just incredible looking when you see them.
If there ever comes a point where they're bred in captivity on a consistent basis, do you think that they'll still hold that mystique?
Oh, I definitely think so, because they're just an incredible python. They're not just the visual factor, but the behavior. They're just very inquisitive. In my opinion, they're very intelligent for what they are. And they're very unique. Each one's different. They have their own kind of personalities. My animals, you know, I come home and, you know, they're either out or they're in their nest boxes. And, you know, within a matter of time, you know, me moving around and cleaning cages or something like that, they'll be out, or one of them will be out, or, you know, it's just, they're very unique for what they are, and not a lot of reptiles, especially snakes, have that kind of interest they're just a very, very incredible snake for what they are.
Right.
I'd imagine they'd be a lot like white-lipped pythons and scrubs, that more people would own them, but it would be people who knew what the hell they were. You're not going to just get Bolins crop up in like a PetSmart.
Exactly. They have that kind of they have that impression when you look at them. You're just like, oh my god, okay, this is a snake that's been around a long time. You know, it's like, I mean, it just has that kind of look to it. It's the one of the indigenous names is translated into grandfather python. I mean, they're this, you know, ancient, you know, kind of mystique about them, which is so cool. So,
very cool. Yeah, I was going to throw, what's your website, just so I have it?
It's MoreliaBolini.com.
Okay.
Yeah, so.
I'm over here checking it out now.
I haven't updated it, and I've got some new stuff I'm going to be updating soon. I'm doing some presentation soon, so I'm going to be putting those up there. I'm going to be at the Midwest Herpetological Symposium presenting, and then over in Reno, I'm going to be going over there to the Reno Herpetological Society and doing some Bolin stuff. So it's always, I always like going and talking to people about Bolin pythons, so it's a lot of fun.
That's awesome. Now, do you find that, who is that person that's coming to those talk?
You know, it's the Herp Symposium, or the Herp Symposium is going to have kind of like a little bit of a higher interest as far as like scientific stuff, I would expect. But
right.
I always do find a lot of novice herpers that are there. That, you know, my biggest goal with the stuff that I'm doing is I really like to speak to people about Bolin's pythons, as far as not just what I'm doing, but what they are, so they really can understand it. And I go in with a presentation, and, you know, 50% of the people there might not know what I'm talking about at all about this snake. And then when they leave, somebody in there remembered something interesting about this animal, and they all are like, wow, that was a really cool snake. I had no idea that snake even existed.
Right.
And that's what I really, really enjoy doing, as well as, you know, researching these animals. I mean, it's one of my, you know, it's, you know, besides my family, it's one of my favorite things to do. It's an incredible experience to be able to go there. I feel extremely fortunate to be able to have seen them in the wild and be able to go there and deal with these people that I work with every day, and then being able to talk to people at these, you know, presentations or these herp societies, no matter how big or how small they are. I just, you know, it's very rewarding. It's great.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I was just wondering if maybe you get, like, you know, other Morelia keepers that, you know, are... If they're, you know, I don't know. That's kind of like the pinnacle, I guess, of Morelia. You know,
well,
if you're,
you know, the Bolin's world is a small world. There's certain people that work with them that have been working with them for a while, including myself. And then there's people that are coming into it excited and that are obtaining animals. And I get a lot of emails from individuals that have, you know, just purchased an animal, and they're saying, you know, how do I take care of it? And as much as I want to say, why are you just buying the snake and just
right.
wanting to, and now you're asking somebody to take care of it. You know, you need to do your research on this animal, you know, with, as with any animal you should, but especially something like this with the rarity of these snakes in captivity, you know, I try to help out as much as I can. And I've met some really interesting people that have, you know, contacted me up saying, hey, you know, I'm a Morelia keeper and I finally was able to get a pair of these snakes. You know, can you give me any information? You know, and I'm like, sure, no problem. You know, here's a whole, you know, write up on some stuff to do. And, you know, if you have any questions, you know, call. You know, my phone goes off way too much. My wife just told me. And hopefully she's listening right now. So.
Okay, cool. You're our we have a couple of different Morelia people that's our go-to for the species. You're our standby Bolin's guy. You know.
Oh, wow. You know, thank you. It's quite a privilege. You know, like I said, I enjoy speaking about the snakes. I enjoy talking to people, so it makes it very easy.
You know, I think they're, for me, just for me, coming from other Morelia, I would just like to have a pair, just to have one, just to have one. You know, there
but
would be one of
those. Just have one. That's
well,
the thing, you know.
I know that all too well.
It's a very interesting thing, you know, people. A friend of mine, who'd gotten some carpets and diamonds, and he was really into it, and he'd been wanting Bolins, and he was a herper, he knew what he was doing, and he's like, I just got rid of all my other Morelia. I'm like, why? What'd you do? He's like, well, I realized I didn't have enough cage space, and I needed to get more Bolins. So, and I'm just like, well, you know, it's like, oh, that's cool, man. I was like, you know, but you had some cool stuff, so. You know, but they're definitely a different league. It's a different snake to work with. You know, a lot of these incredible chondropythons that are out there. I mean, the colors are it just baffles me. Just seeing these, you know, these naturally occurring or even these crosses. I mean, it's just incredible. And I really give credit to these people that are working with them. And then you've got some of these incredible carpet pythons that are being bred and produce these amazing patterns and just genetics, and it's just flabbergasting. And then you've got a Bolin's python, and it's just like, oh my God, it's a Bolin's python. You know, it's like, so it's it's just, you know, it's just really awesome.
Yeah, somebody was talking to me about it and said, why haven't you, why don't you have any yet? And, you know, I don't know, I'm like afraid to pull that. I'm not afraid to pull the trigger as far as, you know, it just, I don't know. They have this mystique about them that, you know, am I ready to take this jump or, you know, I don't know.
Well, you'll be, it's awesome, you know, and you'll be like, oh my God, these things are incredible. I mean, and that's the truth. I mean, they're just awesome.
So you're going to tell me once I get one, I'm going to be putting a 2-for-1 special on my carpet?
Oh, yeah, you just do them. You know, all your stuff will go up on the web and you'll just, you know.
No, you bring them here.
Yeah, I would say you just
watch them.
Give them to Owen, and then, you know, you'll buy all these Bolins.
Well, people kept telling me that's what I'm going to happen with the green trees. They said, you know, I'll get one, and then I'll apparently sell all my carpets and have a ton of them.
I don't know. When it comes to Morelia, each one is different. I find that the one that's probably the neatest for me to look at are my scrubs.
Scrubs, they have that kind of, they have that impression to them when you look at them that, you know, it's like, is today a good day or a bad day? Kind of, you know. You know, and they have that look, you know, and not a lot, and the Bolins have that too, where it's like,
right,
you look at them and they kind of look back at you and they react differently as opposed to a lot of other species that are just kind of, you know, okay, I know the routine, but, you know, anything could happen. it's not to say that Bolin's pythons are aggressive, but, you know, it's like, you know, they look back at you and it's like, okay, I've really got to, you know, it's their choice to decide what's going to happen after this point. So that's the kind of intelligent factor that I really enjoy.
Yeah. That's what I feel from the scrubs. That's why I look at them different. And I imagine in my head that they're probably the same way as, you know.
Yeah.
So I'd feel that. So, see, Owen, you'll want them too. Don't worry.
Well, the problem is that if we go back, because you and I have had these conversations before where I'm like, I wouldn't want that. And then I, you know, a couple episodes later, I'll be like, so I have four of them. And, yeah. So if I say, I don't want Bolins, you know, that'll be the next thing I get. And that'll really make you jealous. And, you know, then you'll strike at me at the rough scale. So let's just mellow about this.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe.
Is there... I'm just looking at the pictures of your of the babies you have. Is there any thoughts to why they have that red type of look when they're younger?
That's actually a really good question. My friend Tom Mendelson, when we were first kind of talking about stuff and ideas, and he had a really interesting idea or theory about it. You know, the soil there is, you know, really high in iron, so it's, you know, it's got that kind of real reddish color in a lot of the spots. And you know, one of the reasons that they could be they could have that kind of burnt red coloration is possibly to help with that, help them camouflage even more into the environment. I personally think that, you know, they rely on that coloration for a predatory defense. I mean, you would think that. I think that the babies go down lower in elevation, and then as they get blacker, go up. But that's just my personal opinion. I think there's more of an abundance of smaller and more frequent prey items at a lower elevation that I've observed that these animals might take advantage of, as opposed to being up higher in there. And I mean, there's a lot of intricate cave work as well too that these snakes could be, you know, inhabiting, and they get a lot of these little bats and these little rodents and stuff like that too. But I'm sure that those babies cruise down lower. To where some of that water, like the stream areas are, and maybe take advantage of some of the frogs and the little skinks that are down there, and, you know, just perch up on some of these plants and snag some little bats and stuff. So, but I think a lot of that red coloration probably aids in a lot as a predatory defense in helping with camouflage.
Okay. Interesting.
The color change is about as it's you would compare it to probably like a green tree from, or a ring python kind of color change, correct? It kind of happens.
Yeah, that, or like a, I mean, as with anything like that, or a green tree python. I mean, they have that, and you know, it's usually within the first couple of years they start going. You know, depending on the animal's growth rate, you know, they start doing that kind of that color change, and they go to that kind of iridescent black. And and then that's when I think the animals kind of migrate up a little bit more into elevation and kind of start going into these territories or these areas where they start developing. But I don't know. I mean, I could be all wrong. I mean, it'd be fantastic to be able to, you know, take a couple of years out there and do radio telemetry and just follow these gravid females and find out where the babies go and really see what they're doing there and where the animals go, because I'm not aware of anybody that's really been able to, besides the collectors there, you know, observe babies or little ones, besides,
right,
you know, a couple people. I know Gunnlund has told me that, you know, he as far as experience with these snakes, in my opinion, he probably has the most experience. He's done a lot of work specifically on these animals in the wild and has observed, you know, countless nests hatching in the wild, as well as babies. So it's you know, it's just a shame that it's so difficult to find the, you know, to find the little ones to be able to get any more data from that, let alone finding the adults. It can be difficult too. So
now there's a theory that the younger ones are more arboreal than the adults.
Yeah,
correct.
You know, I don't think it's more of a theory. I think it's a fact.
Okay.
I mean, adults will take advantage of climbing. If they're given the opportunity, and I was told by locals that they've observed adults in trees feeding off these lorry birds, which is a possibility, but I don't know, because it was just, you know, a couple individuals, so it's just another story to kind of relate back to consider. But the babies, you know, I think, you know, they're safer in an arboreal situation than they are lying on the ground, for some of these, you know, medium-sized rodents that are cruising around, or even some of these birds that are flying by might be able to pick one off. So it's easier for them to, you know, ball up inside of a, you know, a shrub or something like that off the ground than it is to just kind of lie down there and take advantage of like a nest, in my opinion. But I mean,
right,
it's been noted, you know, if you've given these animals options for arboreal access and captivity, then they will take advantage of it, you know, almost instantly. So, which they'll, you know, feed off of it as well as sleep off of it. So,
Huh. Interesting. You know, I one of the things I was, when you were talking about the neonates and the color, uh-huh. I'm thinking about the amethystines, and they have that same crimson red, and so does the Irian Jayas when they're born.
Yep. Yep.
I wonder if that is just a coincidence.
You know, who knows? I mean, like I said, that, you know, the soil out there has got that kind of a reddish tint to it a little bit. I mean, I'm sure it helps out. You know, it's like with the chondros, they have those really bright colors, and
right.
know, to help bait off as a, you know, predatory. It's like, oh, I'm not going to bother this because it's, you know, it's neon yellow or it's neon red. I don't want to even try it. I would assume that it would have to do, you know, primarily with a predatory defense of some kind. But it's really cool to watch the change happen, especially when they get to that kind of mucky brownish black, and then all of a sudden it's just like a couple more sheds and they're just like jet black and they're just incredible looking.
That's cool. Yeah, I think that's one of the things that I also love about Morelia. It's like they start out looking like this, and they end up looking like, you know, at the end they're more phenomenal than, you know, you would have ever thought, you know?
Definitely. Oh, and also, like, I'm glad you enjoyed. I was listening to you guys talk before I got on about the how I have the Morelia complex in the book, too. I'm really glad you enjoyed that. Mark Menza from Germany, who's a fantastic carpet python breeder, put that together for us because he worked on the book as well. And I thought it was just fantastic to be able to showcase, you know, the adults to juveniles. Unfortunately, we weren't able to get Helma Harris on there because it's just a real tricky. I don't even know if there's any photographs of a neonate or a juvenile Tracii. Available, it was cool to get, especially with the Owen Pelly pythons. That was a really cool one. So,
they're mine.
I heard you kind of just gasp.
The thing after Eric's heart is Owen Pelly's.
I mean, it's a cool. I've never seen one. I've seen some cool photographs. I had Grant Husband, who's in Australia, provide those images and stuff, and I spoke to him a little bit. I mean, it's a big, long carbon python. It's kind of gray and tan, but besides that, it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And you just don't see them.
I have picked Owen Pelly, so I just haven't told him about it yet.
I mean, I think they're cool, and I think Carinata is way cool, too, but I mean, it's another carbon python with just really, really, really long teeth. So that's the only difference, in my opinion. And they got green eyes. So
the Helma Harris are definitely a cool snake. I have one of those, and that's probably out of all my snake collection, that one I keep a daily diary on of just its habits and stuff.
Those are really cool snakes. I've had a chance to work with those way back when, and they were. They're really interesting. I thought they're very cool. Very shy. That was the one thing that I really noted with them, that they're just so shy.
Yeah. Now, when you kept them, did you keep them at the higher temperatures that most people?
Oh, gosh, it's been years and years. I believe I kept them hot and wet. I think that's what it was.
Okay.
But I could be wrong. I can't remember. I didn't get to work with them very long. That was the downside.
So
I know there's several people that are working with them right now, and I think there was somebody that was having some success with them. There was one on the forums.
He was on the show, the Philippe, Phil.
Oh, yes, that's
from
right. I actually spoke to him. He's going to be probably putting together a genetic variation thing for me for this new manuscript. So there's another little teaser. So.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. Cool. So, very nice guy.
Yes. Yeah, I noticed that you know, well, like some of the information out there suggests that they should be kept hotter than, you know, other pythons. And I did that at the beginning, but I changed that up, and I noticed a whole different behavior.
Cool.
You know, for instance, if I keep a hot spot during the day, and probably a hot spot gets up to like maybe 95, but the ambient temperature is maybe 80, and then I just click the heat off. It's like a 12-hour on and off. Well, the snake hides it comes out in the very beginning of the morning, goes over in the hot spot, and then goes back under into its hide. And then as soon as the lights go out, it comes out, and then it's moving around, and it sits up on top of its perch. Like, and it's almost routine every night. That
very cool. Yeah, it sounds like the Bolins.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's very cool. Yeah, they're a very interesting snake. The Halmahera Island is just a bizarre place, I've heard, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's, like, no information at all on him.
No, there's hardly anything on it. Yeah, it's just this big volcanic island is about it, you know.
Yeah, so. So I don't know if there's anything else that you wanted to hit on.
No, I mean, you guys have at it. I am here for whatever.
What do you got, Owen? You got anything else? I don't know. I'm like, he's dropping like crazy tonight. He keeps hanging up. Is he there?
Shut up. All right, my phone is having technical difficulties, okay? You're allowed to have your technical difficulties, and I'm allowed to have mine. My phone's been just hanging up randomly throughout the entire interview.
Oh, that stinks.
Yeah.
I had to, like, text Eric. I'm like, all right, I dropped out. Put me back in. Well, it hasn't happened mid-sentence yet, which is, you know, lucky. But, yes, the only thing I could think about is that have you guys ever thought to putting a more naturalistic diet within the bull and eye of, like, actually getting frogs and crap for these guys?
Well, you know, that's an interesting thing that you would suggest that. One of the areas that I was looking into was dietary requirements. So,
yeah.
I mean, we pretty much stick with, you know, the standard rodent diet in captivity for the majority of, you know, snakes. Bolins enjoy eating any kind of a fowl, and I've,
right.
you know, supplemented the quail into their diet as well. So I'll rotate, you know, rodent, quail, so on. And we've had real good success with that. I mean, you know, and as well as sometimes, you know, stubborn feeders, they always go for quail. I would be very reluctant to be able to incorporate any kind of amphibian or any kind of reptile, like a small skink for the little ones, for the reason being the parasitic load in those. That would be the only thing that would really deter me from it, as well as being able to get them off a lizard or a frog diet prior to juvenile to transfer to adult. I mean, I'm sure it could be done, but I mean, it wouldn't be that difficult, but I would be more afraid of just the parasitic load from the amphibians that would go into those guys and could potentially cause you problems in the long run.
Mm-hmm.
I did contact one of the universities about doing the stomach analysis on a couple of the preserved specimens that they had in their collections. And they were like, you want me to do what with it? And I was like, it's like, open it up. I want to see what's inside it. You know, it's like, but nobody was really able to share a lot of light from, as opposed to, you know, what's been observed that they're feeding on in the wild. When I got a hold of that's the copy of the smuggled book, when I had the conversation with Hank Molt, because they had mentioned in there that they had done a paper on stomach analysis on the animals that they collected. And I spoke to him, and he said they primarily found, like, couscous in the stomach of some of the larger animals, but that was pretty much it.
Right. So, like, now, one of the reasons I don't breed hog noses is because mm-hmm. I hear that babies can get stubborn and prefer, like, to be frog starters or something like that. Are you concerned that you may end up hatching these little baby bull and eye and then find out that they are adamant about being started on, like, blue lizards or something like that? Or is this point,
you know,
once they hatch, it doesn't matter, you get them the food?
Yeah. I mean, at this point, I feel pretty confident that we wouldn't have to go with, like, an amphibian or a reptile diet. You know, I would have no doubt in my mind that once these little guys are out of the egg and they're ready to go, that you offer them, you know, a small rodent or a small chick, you know, that they would take it in a second. But on a more naturalistic side in the wild, I would be more believing that, you know, they're going to be opportunistic as they are, and they would come across something like that, and they could potentially feed off of a small amphibian or a small lizard or a small bats that they might be coming across in these little areas that they're kind of roosting for at night. So, but not in captivity. I don't think that would be an area that would really be shedding too much light on reproduction. However, for the adults, I went into migratory patterns of indigenous birds that were found at that elevation as well to see if there was any kind of coincidence between reproduction time and migratory bird patterns that would come in to kind of signal the females that, okay, we have an abundance of food coming, now it's time to eat, 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 and eat. We reproduce, and you know, and then we'll eat, eat, eat again. But I didn't find anything that was really significant that would suggest that, you know, this would be a prime, you know, factor that could potentially lead us to have more success.
Right. You know, I'm just sorry to get on a side note. I'm looking at your Facebook page, the Bowens Facebook page that you have.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm looking at the cover of the concept of your concept cover of the new book.
Uh-huh.
And I can't get over how the Bowens looks so different in the – it has a black head.
Uh-huh.
And then the next coil looks like it's an Irian Jaya pattern. And then the next coil is like the red with like white bands.
Yeah.
That's wild.
There's yeah, you know, there's that we're still kind of toying around with the cover, but that cover was done by Danny, I think it was his niece. She's a photographer, and she took photos of some of the specimens that he had at that time. And the locality that animal is different from, I mean, because primarily most of all the animals that are coming in from the information that I have come in from, you know, one or two different locality sources, and those remain pretty consistent as far as where they're being collected and brought in. So that's kind of in a nutshell what we're exposed to seeing. There are some animals floating around right now that are from different unrelated areas that look a little different. And that animal right there, most likely, I don't know, I think I have the locality written down on it where it was at. And it just looks a little odd. It just looks a little different from what we're exposed to seeing because, you know, it's like, you know, we're seeing one pocket of stuff. So that kind of makes you, you know, kind of consider, you know, the possibilities of differences in these locality populations, but just kind of speculation. But it's a pretty sweet looking Bowens, I have to say.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. That's
yeah.
Really cool. That's wild. Sorry.
No problem. Take a breath. It's okay. Yeah.
I'm trying to share it on my Facebook page, but I can't. I can't do it to the. I'm trying to figure out how to do it to the so everybody can see it.
It could take a while. We're sorry.
Go ahead.
No problem.
One of those.
Your hand
things.
In holding down the fort, would you?
Yeah. Well, oh, dear God. Now the pressure's all on me.
Yep.
So I guess where's your collection stand number wise right now with the bull and eye?
My personal collection is a 2.2. I've got two clutch mate animals, and then I have two unrelated animals that are around the same age, which they come from two different localities, which I was really excited about getting. So and then the animals that we have at the zoo that I maintain, we have a 2.3 right now in the collection.
Okay.
So I get to go play with the ones at work, and then I get to go home and play with the ones at my house. So.
it's a cycle of just
exactly. You know, it's like I have a little bit less you know, playroom with the animals at the zoo because of protocol and stuff. But you know,
right.
For the most part, they're pretty. Pretty willing to let me do a lot of different things and come up with different ideas to try out. So,
awesome. Now, I know that a lot of people who work with difficult species like the bull and eye and like some other types that are out there normally just have a vast collection of, you know, sometimes it gets up to like 10.10 or 10.12.
Yeah.
Why is it that you didn't drift over to getting the massive?
I would love, you know, I would ultimately love to have just a room filled, a bull and eye. My kind of own personal opinion on it, and this is just me, is, you know, realistically, I think we should be able to reproduce what we have in collections now. I mean, there's plenty of animals that, you know, we've got some old animals that we've got in the zoo collections. We've got, you know, young animals and older animals that are in private collections. There should be sufficient enough a sufficient amount of animals to be able to establish a population of snakes without having to have 20 animals in your collection, in my opinion. It's as much as I enjoy having them and keeping them, you know, it's kind of like I'm torn on both sides. It's like, you know, I wish we didn't have to, but same time, it's like, you know, it's that double-edged sword kind of scenario. But I think the people that have, you know, these really big, large collections of them are, you know, they're doing, you know, important things with the animals, and they're going in those directions to benefit the snakes, I would hope. So that's, you know, that's the most important thing. I mean, do I think that they're going to be a cash crop? I don't believe so, because they're always going to maintain a decent price, and they're always going to have that kind of scary factor, I guess, because, you know, they're not being reproduced, and, you know, it's a bones python. But I think with, you know, two groups of animals or two pairs of animals, you should be able to reproduce the snakes without having any problems. In my opinion, anyways, one of the theories that I still kind of hold on to is the male-to-male combat. You know, we've never seen any kind of reproduction stuff in the wild. I mean, wild reproduction is virtually unknown. We know hardly. We know more about them, what we've got in captivity, than we know in the wild. And it could suggest that having multiple animals in a reproduction scenario could be a factor to help out with reproduction. But, you know, with having two groups, you've got two males and, you know, one female. And just, yeah, so realistically, you would think, you know, that you'd be able to reproduce with success. But that's just my kind of opinion. So I know a lot of people are like, you know, well, we can get a larger group of animals. We can have them different ages, you know, different this and that, and try different things, which is, you know, it's a good way to think about it. But I think at this point, I think there's enough animals out there that we should be able to do what we need to do with what we have.
Right. You should be able to figure it out with just kind of your 2.2 is...
Yeah, I mean, like you said, you know, they're a python. They should breed like a python, right? So,
yeah. Keep going back to that.
Yeah, I know. We keep going back to that scenario.
It's such a kick in the teeth with that, too.
I know.
Python. What the hell?
I know. It's the holy grail of the python.
I've heard them described as that, too. And the more I learn about it, the more it's true. It's the biggest thing about Bolani is that they smack you in the face because they're absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah,
they're absolutely stunning. And the from what I hear, you can keep them with relative, you know, once you know what you're doing with pythons and with snakes.
Yeah.
It's not that much hard of a leap.
No, they're a very easy snake to maintain. I mean, the animals. And it goes back to what I was saying before. The animals that we have now are established animals. We're not working with these fresh imported animals that come in with all this, you know, health-related issues and the stress and all that, and it's just a nightmare. You know, we've got animals now that are adults, you know, and mature enough, and you know, you can keep them relatively easy. They're very easy
right.
snake to keep once they've been acclimated. It's just getting to that next level of reproduction. We don't know what we're doing, or if we do, we're just barely understanding what might work, and we've got to be able to replicate it some more to be able to say, hey, this is an area to look into. And that's what is exciting about these two reproductions that we just had, the first one, and then hopefully we get another one, because then it will really kind of open up the window or the door and say, hey, something, okay, we kind of eliminate this now, let's look at this. So
it is. I guess that's what makes them so appealing and so frustrating at the same time. You're right there, and you're so close, but you know, yet so far. It's like, come on.
Exactly. Tell me about it.
Bolens could breed like crazy. If Bolens were like any other, I'd have several. I mean, I think they're gorgeous.
I had a female. Developing 27 to 28 millimeter follicles that were gigantic on x-rays and absorb them within 4 weeks
and just go back to her normal cycle.
Oh my God.
I've got the images will be in the book. I've got a whole two and a half months of developmental images of the developmental cycle of the follicles. So you can see them from itty bitties to these gigantic egg looking shapes. I had I had the vet look at them, and she was like, you've got to be kidding me. She goes, what did you do? And I was like, I don't know. And she goes, those look like eggs. And I'm like, well, and everything. And then that's when I called up David, and I was like, hey, what, you know, look at this, look at this. And she went and she absorbed them at that. I mean, because if I'm not mistaken, you know, a lot of the carpets, you know, ovulated a 27 millimeter size follicle.
Yep.
Or,
yeah.
And I mean, so I was like, what's going on? But so yeah, it's
frustrating, but it's rewarding, and it's because it's like every little step you get a little bit more out of it.
Yeah.
And they kind of make you. They make you kind of appreciate them for what they are and not what you're trying to achieve. So it's like you're looking at different kind of behaviors and traits that you normally wouldn't be paying attention to.
Yeah.
I understand that. It's like, you know, I get frustrated when my, you know, spotted pythons won't breed for me. So, I mean, bull and eye for me is just out of the question.
You, who knows? You might
get out
of
here.
You might pop out like three clutches every year and you'd be like, oh, my God, I was meant to work with these snakes. Get rid of everything else.
Yeah,
yeah,
wouldn't that
course.
Be a kick in the teeth if just?
Yeah,
like,
that would be a real, that would be a nasty one.
Here's Owen, and he just, you know, yeah.
Yeah,
hey,
oh my God,
my
first time. These are great.
Yeah, big deal.
So what do I do with all these things? Exactly.
Oh, there'd be a mob outside my house, but
oh God.
Yeah, I think that I guess my thoughts would be on Bolens is like I would like people just to, I think you might have just said this in a way, is just appreciate the snake for what they are. I love the whole reproductive thing and trying to figure it out and trying to figure out, you know, what makes the snake tick and everything. But I think, you know, after looking at pictures of them and everything, like I said a little bit earlier, is that I would just want them to have them, I don't know if pet's the right word, but you know what I mean?
They're an incredible snake to be around. It's just they there's not many snakes, as hokey as it sounds, that give a, you know, impression to them or this energy that is just awesome. You know, it's like, unfortunately, you know, people got to pay bills, so it's like,
yeah,
you know, that's,
and
you know, but
I'd be
lying if I said I'm not, you know, trying my hardest to try to get successful reproduction, because ultimately that's what we're trying to achieve, to be able to figure what's making these things go.
Absolutely.
But I mean, I enjoy every second that I get to work with them just because of what they are, which is awesome. So
yeah, I guess I guess what I mean to say is maybe people shouldn't be so afraid of them.
Definitely. I agree with that. We've come a long way. There's enough information available, and there's enough people that are willing to talk and share information, including myself, to get you past that kind of fear of keeping these animals. I mean, this isn't the 70s and 80s anymore where they're first coming in. You know, we've got established animals, and we know what we're doing now where we can keep them alive.
Right.
So.
And then if you're lucky, you'll successful breeding them, but
yeah, no kidding.
So
the more people who got them, the more chances there are. So
that's right.
All right, so we're winding down on time, and I just want to get your information out there again. So your website again is www.moreliabolani.com.
That is correct.
Okay. Awesome. Can we get a copy of your book anywhere? Your old book.
Yes.
Good luck.
You can get a copy from Zoo Book Sales. You can contact Eric Thiss. He is the main distributor in the U.S. for it.
Okay.
Awesome. And he has got copies. And then every once in a while, I'll have copies that I'll post up and say, hey, anybody interested? I got a few copies. But he keeps them regularly. So he'd be the person to contact.
Okay.
So
yeah, I definitely would recommend, if anybody is interested at all in Australia or, you know, Bolens pythons, definitely go out and grab yourself a copy of it. And do you have an idea of when your next book is going to be released? Do you have a date?
You know, we're trying to get it out. We're trying to finish up stuff, get like the you know, gist of it all put together. I'm shooting probably for the end of next year.
Okay.
I would like to have it out. But the one thing I learned about, you know, learned with, you know, working on this first book is it's, you know, when you think you've got it done, you've got a million things that you've got to fix. so such a pain. So I would like to say by next year, at the end of next year, I would like to have it finished and ready to go. I know a lot of people were like, oh, my God, when's this book going to come out? And I was like, oh, my God, I mean, it took like almost 6 years to get this thing done. When it finally came out, I was very pleased with how it went and how it was received by people because for what it was. So, I mean, I know I heard you guys saying, you know, how do you compare it to the complete Carpet Python? I was like, oh, my gosh. I was like, first off, the complete Carpet Python is a fantastic book, and my book is just very different from that.
Yeah.
Right. It has lots and lots of fantastic imagery, fantastic data, great information in there. But it's just different, and that's what I was going for with it. And that's what I'm trying to do with this next book that we're working on now, too.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, the only books we have in the Morelia Python Radio Book Club are the Complete Carpet Python and your books. So,
sweet.
I mean, yeah. I mean,
great.
So far it's an exclusive club until, you know,
nice.
Eric and I read a book or something. Yeah, I mean.
Good deal. Well, I'm glad that I'm glad you guys enjoyed it. You know, like I said, I'll say it again. I feel fortunate enough to be able to done what I've done so far and be able to work with the people and be able to be on your show. I mean, your show is awesome. It gives me a chance to really share some more information and, you know, kind of hit on some key points. And I look forward to coming back on. Maybe I can schedule up a time to come back when I get back from my next trip.
I was just going to tell you that. Definitely.
Yeah.
When you're back.
Be good.
Yep. Look forward to talking about that. And when your next book's ready to come out, you know,
come
back on.
Good deal. We have launch series for the book. Now,
that's right.
I
you
guess
tell
if
us
you're
having the book, and then you come back on when the book's out. So
that's right. Yeah, that'll be good. Yeah.
If you're writing a book on Morelia, then I guess this is the place to come.
That's right.
I think so.
I wouldn't go anywhere else.
So check out the website and of course you got the Facebook page, which is cool.
Yeah.
If
you know, one of my big things is, you know, if anybody's got any questions or anything like that, just, you know, shoot me an email. I'm usually pretty quick to write back, and I, like I said, I enjoy talking to, you know, whoever, and especially about Bolin's Python. So, you know, don't be shy. You know, there's no question that's a stupid question.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks for coming on, and
no
forward to talking in the future.
Sounds good. Yep. Thanks, you guys. I appreciate it.
All right.
Thanks a lot.
All right, take it easy.
See you. Another awesome show there, Owen, in the book.
Yeah.
And you will definitely have them someday.
You shut up.
But you can't get them before me. That's just
what
that
happens
way.
If I get them before you?
Oh, I will freaking come over your house and...
and stare at them intently. Oh.
Yeah. And live vicariously through you. And just curse your existence as I look through your glass cage.
I just come down in my room in the middle of the night. Eric, what the hell are you doing here?
I will have
nothing.
I would have to figure out which carpet python you would want more than anything.
We both know the answer to that.
Hey, what is
it? Both the rough scales.
No. I mean a carpet python, like something that I would breed, like I show up with an albino.
Oh, God.
Like,
I don't know. Xanax are on the top of my list right now with carpet python and morphs. I mean,
here I have a purebred caramel, Xanax, tiger jag.
Crazy thinking. Oh, my God. No.
Pure
what the hell is this? Yeah, and you'd be like, I'm going to leave this on the table. If you're going to put a bull and eye on the table, too, I'll walk away with one thing. Yeah, I imagine that's how it goes. I mean, I imagine that's how it's going to go with the Lyasis stuff. I mean, I know, like, I'm going to tell you, like, dude, I got the Waters to breed and the Max to breed and the Alps to breed. You'd be like, I would take a pair of each.
Yeah.
Here is an albino zebra. And I'm like, I will take that albino zebra and run away. So,
yeah,
one
of the cool things that I'm learning this year. Maybe it's not so cool, but when you have snakes to trade with,
I don't have to spend money.
It makes, like, you know, buying snakes all that much easier.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You want this? Yes, I do. Okay, I'll take that one. All right.
Yeah.
And then you move on. I mean,
one of the things I didn't talk about real quick, we're going to go into overtime, but I just want to hit on this on the show. Actually, there's two things. One, did you hear the info about Rodent Pro?
No, I did not.
Do you buy from Rodent Pro?
No, I do not.
Okay, well then.
Should I continue not doing that?
Yeah, I mean, there's just information out there. And basically what they're saying is, let me pull up the article here.
Crap, there's an article. Normally there's an article with stuff that doesn't.
It's just basically saying that Rodent Pro had an outbreak of, oh God, I'm going to butcher this. Lymphatic meningitis.
Oh, sweet Jesus.
It's just something that you should look into. It can be a potentially very serious disease.
Very much look into.
Yeah, especially for pregnant women and their immune system, or people with immune deficiencies.
Oh, that's not good.
So according to Kirsten at the Kentucky Reptile Zoo, the problem was in May of 2012. And I think there's stuff posted up on the BOI or on Urban Jungles Radio's Facebook page. There's the article there. You can go there. So
Rodent Pro done anything to correct this, or
I think that's what kind of I don't know, and I don't want to, I don't like to bash people without knowing the whole story, but
right.
From what I see, if they knew about this and they didn't let people know, that's pretty messed up. And I know that I have bought from Rodent Pro in the past, but I actually switched. To try somebody else, and I'm glad I did.
Yeah, if there is an outbreak of anything at any of these kind of rodent facilities, because there was an outbreak of E. coli at one of them at one point previously.
Right.
That all falls under, USDA. Not USDA. USDA, I think so. Either way. They all have to be inspected. It's mandated to be shut down. They have to be taken care of a certain thing. So if one shipment of rodents got this meningitis stuff, it has to go all the way up the chain back, and then they have to be inspected. The Food and Drug Administration has to come in and check it too. A lot of stuff has to go with that. And the other thing is that Rodent Pro is, as much as we like to think that we run Rodent Pro, the people who buy just for the snakes, it's not true. A lot of zoos get their rodents for their rafters through Rodent Pro and things like that.
Okay.
So you're giving this stuff to not only just our snakes, and it's potentially going into, birds and other small mammals like, bobcats and things like that. They also get this kind of stuff too.
Sure.
So this could be a potential thing that maybe the meningitis doesn't show up in the reptiles. It's just dangerous for the people. But could also show up in the birds. A whole zoo could just lose its entire raptor population.
Right.
And or some rare cat or something could just drop dead. So this is one of those things that,
I think of just having Ari on and, imagine having Bolin's pythons and...
And they drop dead because of a bad rat from somebody?
Oh.
I don't know about you, but I think I would just see red.
Oh, yeah. I guess the biggest thing, though, is the fact that they didn't really let anybody know about it. I mean, I guess situations happen when you're dealing with live animals, but...
of course they do, but...
It's your reaction to how you take care of the situation is really key.
We talked about this a little bit in that last show that it was just you and I, where it's like, okay, we understand deaths happen, sicknesses happen, mite outbreaks happen. It happens. You're dealing with live animals. You're dealing with this kind of stuff. It's how you handle it and how you handle it with the public that makes you either a good or bad business. If your snake that you're sending to a customer drops dead, you have to make it right. If you ship out rodents that are potentially sickly or cause problems, you got to handle it. You got to handle it right.
Right.
So, yeah. I don't know. I really hope that maybe it's not as bad as they're saying, or that, perhaps this is just one isolated incident. but Rodenbrook definitely told people.
I don't see anything that they've issued any kind of statement or anything back. I just basically see these links that say about, it's pretty much Rodenpro with this disease, and it's on the BOI, and that's a shame if that, you would jeopardize your whole business just because of how you handled that, huh?
That lymphatic meningitis can be zoonotic, which means it can transfer from animals to humans, which is why they're saying it could be dangerous for women who are pregnant or people who have weak immune systems.
Yeah, it is. Well, that's what they're saying. Yeah, that it is.
Yeah, now, we would, us who have good immune systems, would have to do something stupid like eat the damn rat to, have a problem where other people which may even have to come in contact with it. So,
right.
So it's
The other thing is, I don't know if you saw the picture that I posted up of the what I called the tiger, but everybody seems to be calling it a tiger jag.
Are we talking about the baby that hatched over here, the red one?
Yeah.
Yeah, the one that I'm the big bald stripe, and they're calling it a tiger jag. Sorry, I'll weigh in on this right now, and this right now. Ready, all y'all.
Yeah.
Shut the hell up. Tiger.
You're saying tiger, right?
Yeah, well, no. Hold on, I have to see this thing again, because there were a few from that clutch that looked tigerish to me. But that's a children's python. So why do we have those? It's another one. You have too many pictures of snakes on your Facebook page that don't belong to you.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, none of these belong to you. I haven't reached a single one. Is it a Morality Pick of the Week?
Yeah, that's what I'm just trying to say.
Well, I'm looking at your Facebook page. Apparently, you just like to put stuff that doesn't belong to you there.
Yeah.
These great. Aren't mine.
Yeah, I don't have these. Here you go.
Yeah, I don't have these, but I will. Or give me a season or two, and I'll be making them.
Yeah. I'm still trying. Oh, wow, that's a pretty cool pick. I'm sorry, I got distracted. There's
I know you did.
Like escalators going down into this alligator pit.
Yeah, don't
do
that.
Oh, no, it's a shark.
Right.
Oh, shit.
All right, I see it.
You see it? Found it?
Yes. Yes.
What do you say? Tiger or tiger jag?
Unfortunately, I weigh on tiger jag.
Tiger jag? Now, I'm curious because... Quite honestly, I don't care one way or the other. It don't matter to me.
Yeah.
What is it about that's making you say tiger jag? I guess maybe I'm just looking at the stripe down the back, and I automatically say
tiger. Right. Stripe down the back. See, now I see that bald back in a lot of the animals I produced here out of my tiger line.
Okay.
Echo.
Okay.
His brothers and sisters. And then I have a new clutch, which is the same pairing.
Okay.
They all have bald backs just like that. Now, where you would get tiger is that you see how at the bald back you have these, the stripes on either side of the back, a little bit thinner.
Uh-huh.
It kind of looks like it's bubbling every once in so often.
Uh-huh.
To make, the tips of saddles.
Yep.
If that was more defined and bolder, I'd say it was a tiger. Also, the yellow stripe is broken, but, broken stripe in the third stripe broken is no big deal. But as you get further down towards the body, towards the tail,
okay,
it just goes from periodic striping to all you get are saddles.
Saddles. Okay.
All the way down to the tip of the tail. And that's almost like the exact same thing I got going on with my tiger jag Jasmine. From about halfway down, all the way down, there's nothing but saddles until eventually she has a patternless tail, which is what your girl almost has there.
Okay. Huh.
So I was in towards tiger jag.
I know when Paul Harris, he weighed in and he said tiger jag, and
I have to bow down to Paul Harris's assessment.
Well, I would think that he's dealt with enough of them that he would know.
You know
what I mean?
I guess he'd have to be you have a tiger jag there. But you had some other stuff in there that was didn't we have two that came out of that clutch that looked kind of tigerish?
Well, that's the one that's a tiger, that we thought was tigerish. And then there's two sibs that I guess would lean towards, like, I don't know if you want to call it that lesser tiger or whatever, but they have, like, striping, but it's the zigzaggedy striping
down
the back.
Well, you know, you can call them lesser tiger, but the big thing is that they're just sibs from a tiger line, so they got the blood to make striped animals, really nice striped animals, but there's nothing genetically morph-wise crazy about them.
Right.
Genetically, they make fantastic tiger jags and tigers and jags just from just being normal coastals. I have, out of my caramel clutch, I have three females that are caramels that have the zigzag pattern from lesser tigers, which is like, okay. So I know if I take you and cross you to any caramel jag, I'm going to get some insane-looking caramel jags.
Oh, yeah.
Super caramel jugs, too. It's going to be nuts. Which, I mean, that's exactly what I did with my Echo clutch. So we're just adding caramel now.
Okay.
So,
yeah. That's cool.
And I got the caramel.
All right. So there it is. Tiger Jag.
Yes.
All right. Now I have to sell it since it's a Tiger Jag.
All right. Now I hate it. It's like,
Yeah, get it out. It's not Tiger. No, it's out.
Just get it there, LA. Well, I don't know. If like, remember, we still got my clutch in September that could be penal female to tiger or penal female to caramel. So who knows?
Okay. And we wait.
And then we wait.
Yes. And then we start breeding again and do it all over.
Oh, my God. Don't tell me that.
Yeah. It's...
Oh, God. October's not the... Oh, God.
Yeah. That's going to be crazy, huh? You're going to be stopping and starting right at the same time.
Oh, holy shit.
There's no break.
Hatched. The adults go down for cooling.
Yeah, it's nuts, you know? So.
Oh, no.
Oh, boy. So, I guess I'll give the official shout-outs for the show. We have... let's see. This Saturday, definitely go and check out Reading Reptiles at Hamburg.
Ask Howard for an autograph.
Yep, Howard will definitely give you one. And if you're lucky, you'll get one from his illegitimate son.
<He's Carl>.
Maybe.
That'll bastard made him buy a red tiger.
Yeah. So, yeah, check that out. He is going to be... He's the host of the 2013 Carpet Fest, which is going to be on May 18th. And you can check out www.carpetfest.com for any future information. Go over to the Facebook page, sign up. You'll get updates through there as we get closer. Of course, there's Morelia Python's forum. Definitely go over there and check that out. They have everything from carpets to Bolins to Owen Pelly and everything in between. So definitely the forum. If you're into Morelia, it's definitely the place to be, and that's www.moreliapythonforum.com. And then we have Morelia Python Radio. If you don't catch the show live, you can go and listen to us on iTunes, and every once in a while, like right now when we're recording and we go into OT, you get the secret little messages that we talk about after.
Mm-hmm.
All the different banter.
Special hidden DVD stuff. I mean,
yeah. It's like the bonus clips of Morelia Python Radio.
Exactly.
So, yeah, you can definitely go over and check that out on iTunes. I would say rate it. You know, I'd like to know what you guys think, which shows you like, which ones you don't. That gives us a better idea of, you know, where we should bring it. I think we need to hit some hard carpet talk the next couple shows because we've kind of been talking about different things. So we need to go back to the roots, some carpet python talk for sure. You can also go over to our site if... www.moreliapythonsradio.com and that of course will take you to all our various Facebook, Twitter, etc., etc. Go over to Blog Talk Radio. You can sign up to follow us. So if we ever do shows at different times or anything like that, you'll get updates, and you'll get updates as far as when the show is going to start. Every once in a while, we get those weird guests from halfway around the world that we have to start at different times. So you'll be in the loop and be able to listen live and get to maybe call in and talk to some of the breeders that you might not be able to talk to on a regular basis. But if you have any future guests that you'd like to hear, any questions, you can always email me at info@BorreliaPythonRadio.com. You go over and check out Morelia Pick of the Week. You know, that's just a little thing that we started that basically encompasses all Morelia. Everything from carpets to scrubs to green trees to bowlings, and everything in between. So, yeah, go over there, post up your pictures to see. Got some cool interactions to go on. You know, some really, really cool projects that people are working on and stuff that people have in their collections, and it's always neat to see. What am I forgetting? Let me pick a speak. I'll throw the shout out to Ari. Definitely, if you can track down a copy of his book, pick it up. Go over and check him out at, like I said before, Morelia Python. Oh, sorry.
Not Morelia Python. Oh, God.
It's at www.moreliabowlineye.com. Yeah,
there
go over and check that out. And he also, like I said, has that little page on Facebook. That's the Bolin's page. You can go over there and check that out as well. And be able to. As far as me, now that I actually have babies starting to become available, check out my website at ebmorelia.com. I have some animals that are up there that are available. You can contact me about that at eric@ebmorelia.com. And we have some cool stuff. So, you know, check it out. And I think that's all I got. What do you got, Owen?
I got that you can check out me at rogue-reptiles.com. We are almost completely up to date. Holy crap. Anyway, you can also check out Rogue Reptiles on Facebook.com. You can check out all the new species that we are working with, updated pictures of animals to come. I've got pictures of the Varnex, our new white, their new black face, white lips, more ring python stuff coming. Tons and tons and tons and tons and tons of craziness moving all over the place. Also, you can check out Rogue Reptiles at the September 8th Reptile Show in the Pocono Mountains. The Gator Boys are going to be there, so it's going to be definitely cool with educational programs done for monitors, alligators, and then for snakes. And I will actually be doing the educational presentation for the snakes. So
cool.
Kind of like an outreach thing to help show people that it's really not that terrifying to have a Burmese python near you. So definitely come out to that. It should be a fun time.
Cool. Awesome. All
right.
Stay tuned. I don't have the guest linked up for next yet. Well, I just
giant mystery.
I don't have it posted up, but I will get that taken care of, and you will know soon enough. So, yeah, stay tuned and tune in next week and for more Morelia talk. Other than that, have
everybody
a good night.
Next week.
All right.